Welcome to 74 Escapes new podcast series, Breaking Bread with Vera Lulu. I'm Vera, and I will take you on a gastronomic journey to explore food as an expression of cultural identity. I'll be hosting chefs and industry professionals from all over the world to discuss everything about this art form that really nourishes our souls. Let's start.
On this episode of Breaking Bread with Vera Lulu, I have the pleasure of speaking with Tom Chenchi. Tom's career launched in the kitchen at Cliveden Hotel, and he continued to own his craft at the Academy of Culinary Arts. Tom has worked beside numerous world-class chefs, including Herbert Berger, Julien Owen-Mould, and Joël Robuchon. He's traveled all over the world from Paris to Istanbul and Canada upon returning to UK in 2010. Driven by his pure love of food, he's considered to be one of London's most prominent and distinguished chefs. Welcome, Chef Tom. How are you today?
It's very good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure having you. Chef Tom, do speak about your childhood and how your love for food has started.
I'm from Italian descent, and you know, Italians are very known for their cooking. And my great grandfather, when he first moved to London, actually opened up a restaurant in Westbourne Park, which is in West London. Unfortunately, I never was able to go to it. It was, you know, a long time ago, from past my time. And when I was younger, for some reason, the kind of cooking in my family kind of was lost a little bit. You know, it just kind of, maybe my family wasn't interested so much in cooking as my past generations were. For something, some reason, some desire inside me just kind of wanted to cook, wanted to learn more about it, and just kind of, you know, at the age of 15, wrote off to a local hotel to get work experience. And they wrote back saying yes, and I kind of never looked back.
I think it's still probably passed on to you. It's in your blood, the love for
cooking. Yeah, it could well be.
So tell me about your first experience, and it must have been very interesting to have your first experience in Michelin star kitchen. That's where you started. So from the beginning, it was absolute perfection and discipline.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my first work was, you know, 15 years old at Clifton Hotel, and, you know, five-star hotel with one Michelin star. I mean, it's kind of really no better place to start, but, you know, it's also tough. You know, it's really, you know, perfection every single day. And when you're 15, you kind of don't really have much discipline. And so you kind of learn that, you know, after time, and it takes, you know, to kind of drill that into you is, you know, you need obedience and, you know, and the discipline to follow up on it. And, you know, it can be difficult.
I am actually a little bit jealous, because when I did start, I've cooked all my life, but when I started professionally, I was a little bit later in my 20s, and I always wish that I started. If I only knew that's what I wanted to do for a living, I would have started at 16, 17. So
yeah, I think, you know, like, and I feel very blessed to have worked where the places that I've worked, and, you know, going to the college that I did to study, and I came with a diploma in catering. But I've met so many chefs that have kind of got into the game late, like 30 years old plus, that, you know, just have kind of a raw talent and always had this desire for food, and sometimes end up being better, if not, you know, kind of more than the chefs that have studied, that have been to catering college, that have studied half their lives and worked. And sometimes you see these chefs, I think maybe they're just more mature and they learn quicker because they're kind of in a situation where they have to. When you're 15, 16, you're kind of not really paying attention. You're just kind of working, yeah, and just doing things. And so, you know, I don't think it's ever too late. It's just, yeah, it's different for everyone, I suppose.
I couldn't agree more. But now, after you have worked, after your first experience, did you think it was necessary then to proceed to go to the Culinary Arts Institute?
Yeah, so the course that I did, an apprenticeship with Clifton Hotel. And when I was 15, I just did kind of like weekends, kind of a few days here and there. And then when I left school, in the UK, we leave school at 16. So you can then go on to college, or you do further education, and then you can go to university from 18. But when you're 16, you can literally just leave and get a job. So I was fortunate enough to do an apprenticeship with them. And I did the Academy of Culinary Arts. And so you do 3 months at college, a year at work, 3 months at college, a year at work, 3 months at college, and then a year at work. It's a 4-year scheme, which I did. And it just gives you such a good base. And normally you kind of, if you go to catering school, what you do in a year is what you would do in 3 months at this, you know, at the college that I attended. So it's very intense. And but I mean, the work experience alone was incredible.
I envy you in a way that you knew what you wanted to do from, you know, such a young age. I mean, as a teenager, I've changed paths like 7 times, but food was always there, and I knew I loved to eat, and then we went from there. But
yeah, I think when I was at school, I think the teachers even said to me then, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And I think I was just such, you know, had such a drive in me to cook and to be a chef. I think that first day in that kitchen kind of just, you know, it cemented it for me. It was just, you know, the camaraderie, the passion. It was just, yeah, I absolutely loved it from day one.
I notice a lot of chefs that I spoke with, they, especially actually British chefs, they just knew. So I think it's maybe it runs in your blood. You said that your time at Lombard Street had a really profound effect on you. So speak a little bit about that.
Yes, I just kind of finished my apprenticeship at Clifton, and you know, 4 years at one place is quite a lot in the hospitality industry. You know, you kind of, especially such a young age, I was kind of just dying to move on and seek other experiences. And, you know, I kind of moved into central London and got a job at One Lombard Street. And at the time it was kind of this, it was in the city, in the Bank District, where it was kind of closed weekends, really quiet and for dinners. And, you know, lots of people told me not to go. And after about 3 months of me being there, it won a Michelin star. And it was kind of like really cemented kind of to say, you know, I kind of make the right move. And but it was just, I suppose Herbert Berger was just, you know, he had such discipline in the kitchen and a great hierarchy. And he really kind of taught me, you know, some, you know, how to manage and run kitchens. But then it was, you know, I'd come from a working environment where I was working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, to all of a sudden having an evening off, having weekends off. It was like almost having a life again. And I suppose with that kind of spurred more passion and more enthusiasm. And yeah, it's just, yeah, life-changing, I suppose.
You and I both share an enormous amount of love for Paris, where you often and worked for the one and only Joël Robuchon.
Yeah.
So tell me, what effect and impact had Paris, the most magical city in the world, had on you?
Yeah, that was an experience. It's beautiful. It's kind of like, you know, when I was, you know, in the 2000s, and back then it was kind of like Paris was kind of the culinary capital of the world. And if you wanted to really be someone in the industry, you kind of had to go to Paris and learn your trade there a little bit. So kind of after Lombard Street, I kind of packed up my bags and moved to Paris. And I got a job at Restaurant Oran on the Champs-Élysées. Joël Robuchon was, you know, the chef patron or chef, one of the executive chefs. And yeah, I was very fortunate to be able to work there. But a bit naive, I remember my first day turning up and basically saying, parlez-vous anglais? Just, do you speak English? And they were like, no. And that's pretty much the only French I knew. And so, yeah, it was a stiff learning curve after that. But yeah, a great experience altogether.
How long did you stay in Paris?
I did a 6-month stage, and so which was long enough. It was a 2 Michelin star restaurant, and it was brutal. It was such tough work. I mean, long hours, long days, and you know, it was. I think we would do up to 250 covers a day, for a 2 Michelin star restaurant. It's a lot, and so it was a huge operation. But yeah, I learned a lot.
It is a huge operation. I've heard that a lot about Robuchon story.
Yeah.
God bless him.
Yeah.
That's actually when I did first fall in love. I moved to Paris like this, and I ate, and that's when I said, you know what, I actually want to cook. So I came back to New York and I started cooking. But probably my first meal at Robuchon in Saint-Germain was one of the best, and it only went higher and better from there, and they just couldn't stop. When people see what I did in Paris is I just ate.
There's worse things to do.
But you're very blessed. I mean, thank God for Eurostar. We can hop on a train and be in a different country in 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah, incredible. Like, you know, it's just when that Eurostar opened, and you know, so many people just do it. I think it was just after the terrorist attacks in Paris a couple of years back. It was really bad, but then there was a big thing from the hospitality industry in the UK to turn, kind of help support them, to go out and help the cafes, the restaurants, the bars, and so many people jumped on the train and just popped over to Paris and tried to support them and give them business, which is just such an incredible thing to be able to do.
Yes. You cooked at Noble Rat afterwards, which actually happens to be one of my favorite restaurants. I really love it. So how did it change the way you cook when you were there?
So I worked for a chef called Julian Owen Mould, and he was the head chef there, and he was very kind of forward thinking in his cuisine. He didn't, you know, at the time there was a lot of, you know, El Roca, and there was a lot of, you know, modern gastronomy going on, lots of, you know, crystallization and gels and foams and things like that. But the way Julian thought was just kind of to think differently about the plate of food that you put onto the menu and the process behind it. And actually it was just, you know, I cooked such classical, from Clifton to One Lombard Street to, you know, to the to restaurant Laron on the Champs-Élysées. It was just kind of such classic cooking. All of a sudden it was, you know, a fresher breath air to be able to just cook something that was very different. And you know, Julian really got the whole team involved. You know, before it was kind of almost, I don't want to say dictatorship where I'd worked previously to that, but the head chef kind of wrote the menu and that was it. Whereas this was kind of like on a Saturday night, you know, it was closed Sunday. So on Saturday night, we'd clean down and we'd have a beer and we'd all sit around the kitchen just kind of till like maybe 1-2 o'clock in the morning, writing the menu for the next week, all together, all putting in ideas. And it was just, yeah, it was so refreshing to be able to kind of see that kind of teamwork. And, you know, because, you know, you need teamwork in the kitchen anyway, but it's just different from when a head chef dictates the kind of the menu, to be able to just all of a sudden you come up with an idea and it go onto the menu. It's just kind of like, yeah, for a young chef, it's, yeah, it's priceless.
I think in general, and I always say this when I speak with British chefs, that London was so different back then. And this is early 2000s, but what it is now, I mean, I literally, pre-COVID, I could just hop in a plane and go and like just eat and have such a fabulous time. There's so many restaurants. It's so different. It's so vibrant, and it's just incredible how it went from from such to such heights. It was. Now it's really unexpected, and I still think that UK is London just has a fantastic food scene.
Yeah, I think British food always had kind of a bad reputation, kind of like Scotch egg, fish and chips, you know, kind of heavy, greasy food, and not much imagination to it, I suppose. That was kind of the reputation, but it was always there. The core was always there, and I think over time that the more the restaurants got better, and the more the public kind of understood what a good restaurant was. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of had no place to hide for the bad restaurants. And so kind of as the bad restaurants closed, more and more good restaurants opened up. The level of cooking got better, the understanding of the food got better. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and it's just, you know, it's led to kind of a revolution in the last 10 years. It's been incredible for London that, you know, there's just so many restaurants now that good places to eat. I think I have like 120 restaurants on my list still go to that I haven't been to yet. That's kind of, and you know, every time I put, you know,
I mean, yeah. I love my Persian food. I love classic, you know, English pop food, or, you know, Kovadis, where I can just go for like eel sandwich and delicious yeah. pie and oysters. And then you've got French and you've got Italian places, and it's just, it's so great. And, yeah. And I think proximity to Scotland and Faroe Islands somewhat is also—it's a very country in its resources.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this—you know—it's almost you don't really need to kind of get the produce from abroad. I mean, you know, Paris is closer to London than Scotland is, but it's kind of—it's you know, the produce that we have here is just, you know, we're an island, we're surrounded by the sea, this beautiful fresh seafood and fish, you know, the amount of farms, the produce that we have, the seasons that we go through are incredible. And it's just, you don't have to get things from flown away all the way across the world just because it's, you know, you have to put it on the menu. Actually following the seasons can be a beautiful thing.
The game, I mean, I pay triple for the game shipping from UK. Yeah. And yes, it's frozen, but what choices do I have?
Yeah.
I love langoustines. It's probably my favorite seafood.
Yeah, but it's incredible. Like just getting the, you know, the langoustines, for example, you know, they catch them and they drive them down overnight to London, and then, you know, it's so fresh, it's incredible that you just can get some such beautiful produce. We're blessed, really, very lucky.
I think that mixed with, you know, if you're classically French trained chef, with the beauty of resources based in UK, it can be a really beautiful marriage in a way.
Yeah, so yeah, indeed.
You guys are very, very blessed. I'm very jealous. tell me about, you had a tasting bowl. And as you know, our platform and my dear friends, they're based there. It's got such incredible arts and culture and history. So when you were there, it must have been really challenging to work for English company. But what did you love so much about Istanbul? What captivated you?
Yes, I didn't really know much about it when I first went. It was kind of I was working for an English company, Harvey Nichols. And, you know, the fifth floor restaurant in London is quite renowned, and be able to go to the chance and to do that in a different country was kind of quite an honor. But, you know, arriving in Turkey, it was kind of a bit of an unknown thing to see what would happen. And, you know, but the culture, the arts, the markets, the bazaars, it's incredible. It's just such a beautiful city. You know, the Bosphorus that runs through the middle, and you've kind of, it's where Asia meets Europe. And it's just, you know, the culture, and, you know, it's just incredible. And the people are so kind. Everyone will break bread with you. It's just kind of, you know, it doesn't matter who they are. They'll kind of invite you into the house, tea, and you know, it's just, it's incredible. Just, it was really kind of...
Hospitality is absolutely natural. It's not fake.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. It's kind of, it's natural to them. It's not like, you know, you have restaurants around the world where it's kind of forced, and, you know, yeah, unfortunately, it's just the way hospitality works sometimes. But it was so natural to in Istanbul. It was just kind of part of them. It was just, it's something that they kind of have to and must do, that, you know, if they're not being hospitable towards someone, it's kind of rude. And so, yeah, it was an incredible experience.
So what were you cooking when you were there? What was the menu like? How did you get inspired? What did you
stick? Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one because it's an English-based, you know, restaurant. And so it's trying to kind of be this English brasserie. But then the produce was, I mean, it was difficult to get. It was just one of those things that kind of, it's not what you know, it's who you know in Turkey and Istanbul. And it's kind of like the markets, the bazaars, or, you know, the suppliers. There'd be days where it'd be raining and then half your produce wouldn't turn up because it was raining. And so you'd be calling up to say, where's my produce? And they're like, it's raining and it's not coming today. And like, what's that got to do with anything? Like, how's it, what kind of excuse is that? And so it was kind of a daily challenge. So it was just kind of to see what's available when, and then just, yeah. And then I think, you know, the company that I work for, Harvey Nichols was franchised out to a Turkish company. Mm-hmm. And they actually bought out Hakkasan with Alan Yao. I think Alan Yao's wife is Turkish. And they bought out Hakkasan, so I helped with that. And so sourcing produce for Hakkasan was very interesting in Turkey. So yeah, a whole different experience.
I personally adore Turkish cuisine. What were the highlights of your time there? I mean, did you have street food? Did you go to bazaars? I mean, you mentioned it, but to me,
yeah,
bazaars are fascinating. But were you in absolute food heaven when you were there?
Yeah, I think so. It's something that, like, you know, we in the UK, we kind of have what we call a kebab, dirty kebab. Like when you're out drinking at the end of the night, you have this kebab, but it's not really, it's more like Greek. It's not kind of like, it's kind of like a Greek English like hybrid.
It's not even Turkish. It's like...
Yeah, yeah, it's nothing. So being actually in Turkey was incredible. They had this thing called tantuni. And so the street food is just like, it's like it's like just a flatbread, and they have all this mince and they have all this tomato and chili in it, and it's just incredible, so vibrant. And this other one, it's kind of like it's called cockerech, and it's just literally just street food, and it's kind of like this meat, you don't even know what meat it is half the time, and they just kind of chop it up and like grill it in front of you. And in the baguette, that was incredible. My favorite was you had these manti restaurants. Manti is like a tortellini. Yeah, it's like a little tortelloni, isn't it? Yeah. And they serve like a yogurt and like a garlic oil. And there was in Istanbul, there's a place called Bebek, and it's right by the river in the Bosphorus. And the manti restaurant there is 24 hours. Always opens. It doesn't matter what you're doing, wherever you are, you can just go there, and it's just incredible. Sit by the river and eat this manti.
Best. Yeah. It's, you know, it's like Bangkok street food and and Turkish. And manti is actually also, I went to Georgia once or twice, and we had Georgian friends growing up in Moscow. And there's lots of Georgian restaurants in Moscow. And I think it's everybody's go-to food. It's so simple, but if it's done right with the sauces, it's just, I mean, I could eat it every day.
Yeah, I know. It's something that's, so homely about it, isn't it? Just heartwarming.
Italian foods, I mean, you have amazing Persian restaurants and Indian. I mean, one of my favorites is Gymkhana. So it's just, once COVID is over, I can't wait to hop on a plane and just go from high to low to kebabs and just, and fish and chips. It's,
you
guys are pretty blessed.
So. Yeah.
So when you came back, you started to, you started Duck and Waffle.
Yeah.
Which was the first 24/7 upscale restaurant. I mean, I personally can't imagine what it's like to even run an establishment like that. So what was that like?
Well, when we first opened, it was kind of like, it didn't have a name. We were hired, and it was an American company, Samba Brands Limited. They had restaurants in throughout the United States. Sushi Samba, they're most famous for. And then they kind of wanted a branch out and come to London. So they had Sushi Samba, and they acquired a premises in the Heron Tower in London, just by Liverpool Street. And it's a skyscraper, and they managed to get the top three floors.
Back in the
day. Yeah, indeed. And then they had Sushi Samba, and then they had a bar, and then the top floor, they just had an empty space, and they wanted to do another restaurant, but they didn't really know what to do with it. And so they just hired some talent, went throughout London, just kind of hiring. And then we came on board, and it was just kind of like, can you just cook some dishes, some food? And then it was like, there was no name for a restaurant, no real kind of idea of what it would be. And then it was kind of like, sprung upon us, shall we make it 24 hours? And it was like, well, this is something that's different and new. And then, you know, we had a few places in London that did it, but it really, demand wasn't there. It wasn't like, you know, Istanbul is 24 hours. New York is very much a metropolitan city where it's just kind of, you know, people out all the time. Even Paris, people wouldn't go out till midnight and then spend the night out. London's kind of very different. People kind of home by 12, 1 o'clock. They start a lot earlier.
It's very spread out, so it's like long distances.
Yeah, and then the owner, his wife's favorite dish in Sushi Samba, I think it was in Miami, was a dish called Duck and Waffle. And it was kind of, let's see it, and we'll, you know, us being British, like, well, what's duck and waffle? And it's kind of a play on the chicken and waffles they have in the southern parts of the States. And it was, you know, a great dish. It was kind of like all of a sudden became this iconic dish. The restaurant got named after it, and then the menu kind of got designed around it. And then, because it was kind of quite a crazy dish, it kind of gave us a lot of freedom to be able to just really go to town and really kind of be crazy with the food. And we kind of became quite an iconic restaurant overnight.
So what else was on the menu? Duck and waffle.
I mean, we had things from like ox sheep donuts, frog au creme brulee, crispy pig's ears. It was just, we really kind of went to town. And it wasn't like in a bad way, though. I mean, some people say, you know, just because you can do it, doesn't mean you should. It wasn't kind of like that. It was just very kind of trying to be original and trying to be kind of playful with the food. Whilst kind of just, you know, I suppose, sticking to like an American British theme that it kind of was born from.
So did you work 24/7?
Well, sometimes, yeah. Like at the beginning, it was tough because it was trying to hire the staff that you could, you know, and trying to manage it. You know, it was busy. You know, we didn't think it would be that busy, and we would do 250 for breakfast, 300 people for lunch, 450 people for dinner, and another 300 people through the night. It was just a beast of a restaurant, 40 floors up in a skyscraper. The logistics alone was just, yeah, you know, it was a massive operation.
This is epic.
Yeah, I mean, I think I did 6.5 years there, which is a long time for a 24-hour restaurant. But when I left, we had close to 50 chefs working all together, not at one time, but, you know, in the brigade. And it was just, yeah, a huge, huge operation.
6.5 years probably felt like 50.
Yeah, close to it, yeah.
Kudos to you. I really admire and respect it. It's sounds scary. I did work in Japan where I was working quite a lot as well, but it was definitely not 6.5 years.
Yeah.
It's really spine chilling. We obviously had a very challenging year, everybody in the restaurant industry and those who are not. So what kept you busy during Corona? How did you handle it mentally, physically?
I mean, it's a really tough question because it was just kind of sprung on us, wasn't it? It was not something that kind of anyone planned for. And the strange thing is kind of it's affected everyone. It's not just like something that's, you know, affected one city or one country or a certain group of people. Actually, it's infected everyone throughout the world. And so, like, overnight, we've kind of just gone to this kind of new life, which is it's very strange for a lot of people. And, you know, everyone's had to adapt quite quickly, even though they probably weren't mentally prepared for it. And, you know, I still think now, almost a year on, that people still kind of don't realize, you know, the severity of it all and you know, and how harsh it has been on people with just, you know, mental health and fitness and just kind of looking after each other. You know, people are secluded away, and unfortunately there's people out there that kind of, you know, don't have the means and really do need the help. And, you know, when it first happened, I just opened a restaurant. It'd only been open 6 months, not even that, I don't think, before the virus hit. And we were forced to close due to lockdown. And then unfortunately, due to finances and you know, without the support that was there, we couldn't reopen. And, you know, we had a business that, you know, we were kind of looking forward to the future. We just had some really good reviews by some great, you know, food critics in London. You know, just got through a big refurbishment, Christmas period, really just starting to kind of pay back the kind of money that we owed from opening the restaurant to being forced to close. And you know, all of a sudden rent's building up, bills are building up, and just, you know, how do you pay the staff? There was, you know, thankfully there was the furlough scheme, but still you still had to pay, you know, PIOA and tax. And unfortunately, just, you know, as much as I had a restaurant kind of taken away from me, which is, yeah, was, you know, very brutal. And you just, yeah, because it was kind of out of your control as well. It's not something that I'd opened a restaurant and then 2 years later it shut because it just wasn't busy, or, you know, I hadn't achieved the goals that I'd wanted to achieve. It was kind of taken away. Yes. Yeah. And so it was just kind of like, wow, what happens now? And so, like, now I've got the, you know, just put everything into this restaurant and now I don't have it. And now I'm just stuck at home and I can't work and I can't go out. Like, just, this is a bit surreal. This is very kind of, yeah, what next? And thankfully, London's quite a prominent place where the hospitality industry really kind of comes together, you know, especially in times of need. And, you know, there was support out there of consultancy work that I was doing, helping other restaurants. And then I had the chance to do residency with Stony Street in Borough Market in London, and yeah, really, really great success. But again, halfway through that, there was another lockdown, and so, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's each week seems to be you're planning for something, and then the week after you're planning for something totally different. And I think you've just kind of got to keep adapting and keep learning from each week and day by day, and just keep trying. I think you just can't give up. You just got to stay tough and stay strong.
I think as hard as it is for chefs in the restaurant industry to accept this because it's been a roller coaster for the last year. We're still in a business where every day is adaptation to a new day. So anything we handle it better than everybody else, because every day is a complete surprise. You're on pins and needles at all times. This is a completely different level, and it's very undeserved, and nobody has seen it. It's been going on for a long time now.
Yeah.
But I still think it's everybody adjusts in a way. And
I think you've just kind of have to. There's not like, you know, there's no point just sitting at home and moping and being like, this is no good. You just got to kind of try and get out there and do things and just do the best you can do, and you know, hopefully it gets you through these tough times.
What are your hopes and predictions for 2021? Once it gets better, what are you, is there any projects you're working on currently?
Yeah, so I mean, thankfully the vaccine is here and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully 2021 can kind of give us some normality. And you know, I've got some projects on the go at the moment, some I can't mention at the moment. I've got some, you know, some really kind of hopefully interesting things coming up, and some great, you know, opportunities in the future, which I'm just kind of in talks with some people at the moment, and we haven't kind of sided on the dotted line yet. But if we do, then yeah, things can hopefully look, you know, a lot brighter for myself. And you know, London, this, you know, even during the pandemic, there were restaurants opening, you know, and there's still talks of restaurants being open now and throughout this year. And it's a tough year for everyone, but I think we can keep moving forward. It just, you know, hopefully it's going to be a good end to the year.
And one last question before I let you go back to your busy schedule. Favorite food, comfort food, what's your go-to?
Wow, that's tough. Like, it sounds, it's going to sound really bad, but a spaghetti bolognese is like...
I do too!
I don't know what it is. Like, I think it was one of the only dishes my mum could really cook well. And just growing up just kind of always reminds me of that. If I'm really down and I kind of need like just that comfort meal, it has to be that. Otherwise, if I'm kind of cooking at home, I really kind of experiment and just kind of go a bit crazy. I cook a lot of Asian stuff at home just because I don't really cook that in my cuisine at work. So it's just nice to be able to kind of cook with that at home. It's not very good, but that's why I just cook it at home.
Now tell me, how do you cook your bolognese?
Oi, we give here for another hour. Yeah, so just like I start with just garlic, and I use garlic and shallots. In Italy, they don't use the really both together, use garlic or shallots, but I use garlic and shallots. I sweat that down. Mm-hmm. And then I roast the mince in the oven. So you take the mince and you roast it in the oven, and you can get a really nice color on it, and actually some of the fat drains out too. And then you take that mince and put it with the with your sweated shallots and garlic, and then tomato puree, and let that cook out. And then while you're doing that, you take the roasting tray, drain the fat off, and then deglaze it with red wine. Uh-huh. Put that into your bolognese, into your meat, let that reduce down. And then I put a passata, so just, you know, tomatoes. You can either cook it yourself from the side, or just, yeah, there's great jars out there. So I start it in and then just let it slowly cook out. And then I put what I call pizza spice in it, but it's like Herbe de Provence, I think, or like mixed herbs, but it's kind of like dried herbs. And I don't know, that's just kind of, that's what my mum would always put in as a kid. So I put that into, and then just let it cook slowly, 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 and just let that cook out as long as you can, add in a little bit of liquid as and when you need it, and that's it. Very, very simple.
It's very interesting to see your take on this, because I speak to everybody about, it's a great debate of bolognese, and especially with Italians.
Yeah,
I love your take on this. I'd love to try one day. The way I do mine is I like to use three different kinds of meat, obviously pork, veal, and beef.
But yeah,
I chop it, so it's a chopped meat.
Yeah.
I sweat down the shallots, the garlic, this and that. I cook the meat down, I mean, caramelize it. I add brunoise, carrots and celery.
Yeah.
Bottle white wine. a little bit of tomato paste or a little bit of tomato puree or like the sauce that I make. And herbs de Provence, but I like fresh rosemary and I'm crazy for rosemary and thyme.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do add a bit of chicken livers.
And
Italian told me, actually, don't judge, but he said a drop of fish sauce makes an amazing difference.
Yeah.
Made it warm and cook slowly for 3 hours. And I do, I actually like harder pasta with it. So I like really nice spaghetti. Like Italian brand and super al dente and it's just like, wow.
Yeah, I'm the same. If I do bolognese, it has to be spaghetti. Otherwise, if I'm cooking a different pasta, then I'll never do bolognese. I never mix like bolognese and a different pasta. If I'm doing like penne or a fusilli or something, I'll just do a totally different sauce. Right.
And
I'll
I like my own pasta personally. I like the twirl. I'm not a rigatoni penne kind of girl.
Yeah, same. Spaghetti all the way.
Chef Tom, it was such a pleasure to break bread with you. Thank you so much for your insights and beautiful experiences that you shared with us and our platform. We'd love to see you in London. Lights out.
My light just went out on my apologies. Is that better? Like
over a nice cup of tea or a little Guinness, and let's stay in touch. And we're looking forward to your recipes and stay positive and hopeful, and God bless, and thank you so much.
Yeah, pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.